As we head into summer, you know, this is a good season for do-it-yourself projects. I want to tell you a story about one of mine. When I was in my late 20s, it was probably 25 years ago, we owned a little house in Champaign, Illinois. House built in the 20s. It was a cute little house, but it needed a lot of work done. And I enjoyed doing, you know, projects, the kind of things I could take on. And part of that was I remodeled the bathroom. Now, this was a two-bedroom house with a little bathroom between the two bedrooms. This is a small bathroom. Probably the footprint is 5 feet by 7 if you measure it to the tub. Maybe not even that large. Small space. And as part of that remodeling, I found out I had a really slow drain in the house. Just the main drain. Probably tree roots, the neighbors told me. So I researched how to handle the problem. Now understand, this is before the internet, so you know, just 30 seconds figure out, you know, go watch it on YouTube how to do this. So I talked to experienced homeowners, I talked to one or two people in the church who were pretty handy. And all of them said to me, call a professional. They have the equipment, they have the expertise. It won't take them very long, Jay, really. And I can't remember if I was worried about the money, which we always were, or I just needed something to boost my ego, but I decided to take it on myself. Yeah, I know. So I went to the rental place, and I rented, you know, basically a machine to clean out your drains. But all the normal size ones had been rented out. So I got the Big Daddy machine. And I think it's the kind of thing the city of Champaign used to clean out the storm sewers. And I put this in the back of my little wagon. And on the way home, turning a corner, it fell over and ripped my liner on my the top of my inside of the car. That was just the first step. Don't go, oh, yet, till you've heard more. So the only way I thought to do this was, I'll go into the bathroom and I'll just take the whole toilet out. And I'll go down through the toilet drain into the main drain of the house, right? Okay. Very tight quarters, okay? So I've got this big monster machine in there with me. Took the toilet out to another room. Susan, by this point, had taken the children and gone. So it's like, we're out of the house. We're going to the backyard or the park or something. So I started this, and you know, it's if you've ever seen one of these, they're coiled on a reel, and then there's a motor that causes the blades to rotate. So it's a turning cable with blades on the end. It's a lot of fun. You let it go down the drain for a while, and then you pull it back up. Anybody ever seen this done or done? Okay. Down the drain a little further, and you pull it back up. So far, so good. Well, what started to happen is I would pull it back into this tight little bathroom. And the stuff that was down the drain, we'll call it grease, started to come up the drain with the spinning cable and was getting sprayed all over the walls. But I thought, that's okay, I'm remodeling the bathroom, it'll be okay. Because these walls are, you know, I'm going to redo these walls. At least you're with me. All right. Then, I don't know, it was out maybe 30 feet. I thought, I'm getting this. It hit something, probably whatever the obstruction was. It hit the obstruction, and the machine recoiled. And it bucked back on me. And my hands were crossed, caught in the cables. And I couldn't move. In this little tiny space with the machine still whirring, and my fingers now, you know, any hopes of my concert pianist career were quickly fading. And I only knew what to do, which was scream. Now, I can carry my voice pretty well, but I screamed, and I wasn't hurting that badly, but I was starting to panic that no one was around. And I screamed bloody murder. Right, Susan? And I think Susan thought my hands were coming off, so she came in to help and turned off the motor and freed my hands. So here I am. Things are a mess in this little house, this little bathroom. My nerves were frayed, probably everyone else's too. I spent a lot of money anyway, and to top it all off, I still had a clogged drain. The next day, I called Roto-Rooter. They came out, they accessed the drain, smart, through an opening in the backyard. They cleaned it out in 15 minutes. They handed me a bill. The bill was less than I had spent on the rental. So I had a problem. I did have a problem. I was told how to fix it. And I decided to do it my own way anyway. Now, over the years, I've learned a little about when to do it myself or when to call a professional. And, you know, part of the conversation around that, well, is this a Roto-Rooter type of thing? You know, I thought of this episode because in reading 1 Samuel, Israel had a problem. They did have a legitimate problem. But God had given a plan to them. God had given them a relationship as his people. But they demanded their own solution anyway. My decision was foolish. It was just stupid. It was dumb. But their decision was sinful, and it led to disaster in the life of that nation. You know, it's important for us to identify in our lives what God is doing, the ways that God is seeking to lead us, and then to follow that. Because when we demand and pursue our own way, that's a path to heartache. And you might say, well, you know, I took my own way once and it didn't hurt. It hurt someone. And while receiving God's good provision is our way to blessing and fulfillment as his children, that's the way to go. That's the way to have life, to choose life and not death. And we're going to look at this passage from 1 Samuel just for a few minutes today. You know, for many years, Israel had had a special relationship with God. They were not like the other nations. They were a covenant people called into relationship with God. They were led by judges and priests, prophets that God had ordained and appointed. They were not a warring people except to defend themselves. And they were protected and nurtured by the national relationship they had with God. They had a great setup. But they did have a problem. The problem was this. Samuel, the judge and the prophet, was getting old. He was coming to the end of his life. Did you remember the story of how God had called him when he was a child? And he thought it was Eli, the old prophet. Well, he had been actually given the role of prophet and judge because Eli's sons were wicked. It would have gone to them. But instead it passed to Samuel because of the wickedness of his sons. And now Samuel's sons were corrupt. Preacher's kids, right? Mine are good. So there was a real problem of what do we do when Samuel dies? The leaders of the nation are saying, we've been here before. We've seen this before. We need some new solutions. We need a new way to walk, perhaps. Some other options. So the problem and the situation were real. What was happening inside Israel really did lead them to need to seek some new ways. But what they forgot is that they were God's people and that God had promised to provide for them and to lead them and to care for them. So instead of seeking God's way for the way forward, they came up with their own plan. Give us a king like the other nations have. Now, this was a personal offense to Samuel. Certainly, he took it that way. And he went to the Lord. And the Lord brought perspective and comforted Samuel. He said, you know, Samuel, it's actually not you. It's not about you. It's me they've rejected. And they've rejected me and been rejecting me from the day I brought them up out of Egypt. So go ahead and listen to them. This is the way they're choosing. This is the way they want to go. But warn them about what it will mean. You know, it's true that God did have a plan to establish a kingdom at some point. I mean, think about that. The kingdom that would last forever. But at that point, God was their king. That's the way it was constituted at Sinai. When the law was given, there was basically a contract. You are mine, and I am yours. No one else could have a relationship like this. No other people had received blessing like this. And what they were, in effect, saying, no, we want to change the rules. It's not about Samuel, it's not about Eli, it's not about Deborah, or any of the other God-appointed leaders. They wanted a new system of government. They wanted a new institution. They were demanding a complete overhaul. Give us a new constitution, is really what they're saying. It's important for us to note why they were demanding a king, because that's what all their neighbors had. Strong, powerful, influential, victorious nations. And they all had kings. And Israel looked around their borders and said, we're the only ones without a king. What is up with that? And they were tired of being different. They were tired of being unique. Israel had been set aside as a special possession of the Lord. They couldn't be like other nations. They weren't like other nations. They couldn't have the gods that the other nations had. They were called to a peculiar journey with God. And they were just tired of it. They lost their connection. They had allowed it to grow cold. And in this demand for a king, as one commentator puts it, is sinful in its motives, selfish in its timing, and cowardly in its spirit. Say that again. That's not my words, but it really caught me. Demand for the king right now was sinful in its motives, selfish in its timing, and cowardly in its spirit. So Samuel does what God says. He goes to the people and says, all right, let me tell you what it's going to be like to live under a king. And like warnings on cigarette packets, you know, you wonder if they'll really understand, if they'll really heed it, but they don't. Let's look at verses 11 through 20. I just want to read them. They were read beautifully. In my dreams, God sounds like Charles, you know. So. Thank you, Charles. This is what the king who will reign over you will claim as his rights. He will take your sons and make them serve with his chariots and horses, and they will run in front of his chariots. Some he will assign to be commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and others to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and still others to make weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive groves and give them to his attendants. He will take a tenth of your grain and your vintage and give it to his officials and attendants. Your male and female servants and the best of your cattle and donkeys he will take for his own use. He will take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his slaves. When that day comes, you will cry out for relief from the king you have chosen, but the Lord will not answer you in that day. And they say, no, we still want it. Now, this is such a sad and tragic turn for Israel. God wasn't opposed to the notion of kingship. It was his idea. But not this king, and not this time. He wanted them to trust him, to return the love he had given, to show gratitude for the special protection that only they had. But see, they were blind to what God was doing. They were spiritually blind, and it played out tragically in the life of their nation. And one of the questions I have is I see this, is how do we have eyes to see what God's up to? I mean, they missed it. How do we keep from missing it? How do we pray for God's will rather than our own? How do we keep from demanding kings when God is wanting to give us something better, namely himself? As we look at the gospel passage, we see that the teachers of the law miss what God is doing. I mean, they really miss it, don't they? They say Jesus is from the devil. That's a big miss. And not only do they miss it once, but they live in an ongoing and perpetual blindness of their own choosing that keeps them from opening themselves to the grace and the life of God. And that willful shutting down of God's intention is a sin that cannot be forgiven because they will not. They close their eyes to the truth. It's like trying to talk to someone, if this has ever happened to you, and probably not, but try to talk to someone and they don't want to hear you. They just go, la, 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 you know, like, don't tell me that. No, it's you're not listening. We cannot have a conversation. The teachers of the law would not hear, and because of that, they were in a state of sin that could not be forgiven. In Paul's letter today to the Corinthians, he says, yes, things are difficult, but we don't lose heart because inwardly God is working. God is renewing. God is doing that deep thing deep in us, helping us to know an eternal glory. So we don't look at what is seen. We look at what is unseen. Not on the temporary, but on the eternal. Not on the kingship, but on God himself. That's where our hope is. It's to pray to have eyes to see what God is doing. See, that's how we pray. To know the reality of the unseen, to be given eyes and ears to see and to hear. The leaders of ancient Israel, they just couldn't see, and their disobedience and stubbornness made it impossible for them to see. So they had to endure the reign of King Saul and other wicked and ungodly kings down through the centuries, with a few good ones thrown in. But even the good ones had problems, right? They weren't like God. Even if they were after his own heart, they weren't like God. Do we see what God is doing? Are we tired of how God is calling us? Of what it means to be a follower of Jesus, to be a disciple? Are we tired of wanting to think and act like a follower of Jesus? Are we tired of being different in our world, different in our culture? Are we different? Are we tired of the community that God's given us? Do we want to be like everyone else? Or are we glad to receive the unique gifts that God has prepared for us and only us, to walk in that? Those are important questions. My father, when I was a child, my father used to travel a lot on business. And that was a time when you just didn't sort of decide on Wednesday you were going to go to Italy or something, and you'd leave Friday. I mean, you know, we travel really easily now around, and it's exciting and wonderful, but it was very different 45 years ago. And he went to such exotic places. He went to Israel and Lebanon and Iran and Saudi Arabia and Jordan and Portugal, and one time he went to Starved Rock, you know, all these exciting places that that Caterpillar took him on business. And often he would bring gifts back to us. Now, there were four boys, still are, four old guys, older guys now. And sometimes I would see a gift that my brother got. It would catch my attention. I'd think, I really like that. And I think my father would see what was going on. You know, he was never harsh about it. He never sort of scolded us. But he would catch my eye, and he would look at the gift that I had, and he said, you know, I picked that out just for you. Just for you. And all I could think then was my father away somewhere in some bazaar, looking at something and saying, that makes me think of my son. See, God is like that with us. Sometimes we want the gifts others have. Sometimes we want the kind of ministry that other people have. But God's given us a gift for us, a work to do that's ours. You see, our prayer, this summer of prayer that I'm encouraging us in, it's not to receive a strategy. I can do that in a couple minutes. It's not to receive a plan. It's to have our eyes open to the vision of what God is doing, who He is and who we are. And you know, out of that, then the steps to follow will be, we'll just know what those are. They'll be clear. Yesterday, and this, I want you to think about this as I close the time. Yesterday on the church calendar was the day for Columba. Columba is the abbot of Iona, that great missional community of prayer, a Celtic missional community. Tomorrow is the feast day of St. Barnabas, the son of encouragement. And here we are between the missional abbot of Columba and the guy with the heart of encouragement. I think it's kind of our mission too. I really do. Amen.